Let's talk about the tides. I'm pretty sure you know what tides are. It's when the level of the sea rises and falls over the course of the day. And if you live anywhere near the sea, you know that timetables are published on a regular basis showing the exact times when high and low tide will be reached every day for a month or even for a year in advance. And I think most of us are pretty sure we understand how this happens. It's something you learn in school when you're very small. And the problem is that because we learned a simple explanation when we're young and we feel like we understand it, we tend not to think about it too hard. And if somebody actually sits you down and starts asking you to explain it, let's say your own children ask you to explain the tides, and they start asking for more and more details and they start pressing you on it, you fall apart pretty quickly because it turns out that what we understand is so simplified that it doesn't answer basic questions. Like, for example, if the moon causes the tides, why are there two high tides in a day and not one? So let's look at the history of our understanding of the tides. If we go back a few thousand years to the ancient Greeks, it might surprise you to hear that the ancient Greeks didn't know about tides. They'd never seen them. And the reason for this is that they lived on Greece is on the Mediterranean Sea, and the Mediterranean does not have tides. It wasn't until around about 325 BCE when the explorer Pytheas discovered the Straits of Gibraltar and sailed through them into the Atlantic Ocean. And while exploring the lands beyond, he noticed a very strange thing, which was that, unlike at home, the level of the sea would rise. The water would climb up further and further up the beach, and then it would settle back down again, go further down. And it would do this at regular intervals. So this fascinated him. So he took very careful notes, and he found that the high tide happened twice a day and the low tide happened twice a day. And that the full cycle of high, low, high, low took a little under 25 hours, about 24 hours and 40-something minutes. In fact, it seemed to coincide with the moon, so that a high tide would happen when the moon was at its highest point in the sky, and then a low tide at when the moon was setting, and then another high tide when the moon was beneath the ground, and then the final low tide would be when the moon was just starting to rise. He also noticed that over the course of a month, the high tides would get higher and the low tides lower. He noticed that these spring tides, the higher of the high tides, coincided with the full moon and the new moon, while the neap tides, when the difference between high and low was at its smallest, coincided with first and third quarter, or the half moons. So he figured, obviously, the moon must be causing the tides, which is probably what most of you already know. The problem here was that for the next 2,000 years, nobody took this explanation very seriously. You might wonder why, because astrology was such a serious, well, science over that time. In fact, most of the history of astronomy was really astrology. We studied the stars to understand and predict their movements so we could better predict what our futures were going to be. So the idea of things in space having some weird magical effects on stuff down on Earth wasn't that strange. The thing is, though, two high tides in a day? If the moon is exerting some kind of force on the water, then you would expect a high tide when the moon is at its highest point in the sky, which we get, and then low tide when the moon is furthest from its high point. In other words, when the moon is beneath our feet. Instead, we get a high tide then. So the timing was completely out, and that's why people thought it could never have anything to do with the moon. It wasn't until the 17th century when the answer finally came out. Now, people don't necessarily realize, but it was well understood that the stars and planets, well, the planets and the moons, moved through the sky and that they moved in orbits. The understanding of what these orbits looked like didn't match what we know today, but it was definitely understood that the moon went around the Earth, because any fool could see it if they just stayed out and watched it from night to night. something which people today just don't seem to want to do. They'll watch YouTube instead. The big revelation, though, came when Isaac Newton came up with his theory of universal gravitation, which explained how the planets and moons were able to move in the pods, which astronomers were only just beginning to realize was the true shape of the solar system, how things actually moved. Now, the interesting thing about gravity was that he figured it was the same thing that makes something fall. The famous, probably not true, story of the apple falling on his head, when he realized that that was also what made things fall through space and around each other into these nearly circular orbits. A key part of gravity, as predicted by Newton, is that it obeys what we call an inverse square law. This means that the strength of gravitational attraction between two objects is dependent on the distance between them. And so the idea is that if you double the distance between them, then the gravity is a quarter as strong. If it's three times as far away, the gravity is 1/9 as strong. Inverse square. Now, if you look at the Earth and the Moon, and you apply this inverse square law, and you look at the distance between the Earth and the Moon, and the size of the Earth, its diameter, and then you work out the maths, you'll find that because of the inverse square law, the Moon's gravity on the side of the Earth closest to the Moon is 7% stronger than the Moon's gravity on the far side of the Earth. So that explains one half of the tides. The Earth's the waters of the oceans are more strongly attracted towards the Moon on the near side. Now, this isn't so surprising. This is common sense and it should have been obvious. But the second part of the puzzle, what's making the other tide? I'm going to say a dirty word here. Your science teacher at school is going to be very upset. Probably your physics professor at university if you went there. And that word is centrifugal force. Now, I know centrifugal force it's not a real thing. It's not a force. But it is an effect. We're all familiar with it. You do the old swing a bucket over your head, nothing falls out. And I know, strictly speaking, it's a centripetal force. But the experience of something in the bucket would be a force pushing them towards the bottom of the bucket. So for the sake of this explanation, we're going to pretend that the effect that we feel as centrifugal force is real. Okay, centrifugal force. The Earth and the Moon are spinning around each other, right? So the far side of the Earth from the Moon experiences a bit of centrifugal force. And so the result of all this, these two factors, means that we now have two bulges of water. In fact, a better way to look at it is that the Earth is, in fact, slightly stretched between the side nearest the Moon, being drawn by gravity, and the side furthest from the Moon, being swung out by centrifugal force, right? And because water is much softer than rock and can flow, the water makes the biggest part of that bulge. So you've got a bulge of water near the Moon and a bulge of water on the far side of the Moon. And as the Earth rotates over the course of the day, the bulges are steady, they're not moving, but relative to the surface of the Earth, they are, and they're swinging all the way around the Earth once every day. As the bulges move around, you get a high tide, and as the low points arrive, you get a low tide. So there you have it. Two high tides and two low tides. Now, if you think back to the beginning of the story of Pytheas, you'll remember the bit where I mentioned that Greece had never known tides before. The Mediterranean does not have tides. Why? Well, the Mediterranean is almost entirely landlocked sea. So the only way that water can flow in as the bulge arrives is through the Straits of Gibraltar, which are quite narrow. And the water can only flow through at a certain speed. And the Mediterranean is quite large. So by the time enough water flows in to an amount that we can actually see, the tides have already changed and the water is flowing out again. So technically, I suppose it does have tides, but they are so small, no one has ever noticed them. There's a final part of the puzzle here, which is why the tides vary over the course of a month. And the answer there is the sun. Now, the sun also has gravity on the Earth. In fact, being 27 million times more massive than the Moon and only 392 times further away, the sun's gravity is 176 times stronger than the Moon's. But there's a big difference here with tides are concerned, which is that that 7% difference from the near and far side of the moon comes from the ratio of the distance between the sun and the moon, the Earth and the moon, and the thickness of the Earth. Now, because the distance to the sun is so much greater, as a percentage, that difference is really, really tiny. So the tides due to the sun are much, much smaller than the moon's. When the sun and the moon are lined up, those two tides add together, and your tides become bigger. You get a spring tide. And when they're 90 degrees apart from each other, that's when the two sets of tides cancel each other out, and you get the neap tides. And this is why your spring tide happens at full moon and at new moon, because that's when the sun and the moon are lined up. And it's why your neap tides are at first and last quarter, because that's when the sun and the moon are 90 degrees apart in the sky. So that's basically it. That is how tides work. That is why the water level climbs and falls at over certain parts of the Earth at different times of day. Tides, in fact, manifest in various other ways, because it's not just the water that is affected by gravity. It is the very rock that makes up the Earth itself. And in fact, it does flex very slightly, although nowhere near as much as the water. Certainly not enough for anyone to have ever noticed it before Earth-observing satellites were able to measure it very precisely. And it leads to some interesting, this concept of tides leads to all sorts of interesting things, including what we call a Roche limit, where if two orbiting bodies are close enough together, the tides are strong enough to break apart the rock and the objects fall apart. But that is a topic for another episode.